Welcome to Main Street on Giving Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we celebrate the spirit of generosity that Giving Tuesday inspires. North Dakotans can participate by donating to local nonprofits, volunteering, supporting community initiatives, and leveraging perhaps matching gift opportunities, or simply spread awareness. This is a global movement that encourages us to strengthen our communities by giving back. Whether through time, resources, or advocacy, we hope you'll join in making a lasting impact across our state on this Giving Tuesday. In the second half of today's show, we'll visit with Merrill Pepcorn. Many of you know Merrill as the voice of Dakota Datebook, but you also may know he recently ran for governor of North Dakota. We'll hear his reflections on the campaign and what he's learned along the way. But first, Dr. Clint Boyd joins us. Dr. Boyd holds an advanced degree from the University of Texas. He is North Dakota's senior paleontologist and leads the paleontology program for the North Dakota Geological Survey, and he also curates North Dakota's state fossil collection. Dr. Boyd's expertise ensures the preservation and exploration of the state's rich fossil history. Dr. Boyd, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
We are very, very pleased that you're here. We have a lot to talk about with you today. I want to begin with a discovery of sorts that's been going on for a few years underneath a garage in North Dakota, the site of potentially mammoth remains. I would like you to bring us up to date on that and also maybe start with the history of how it was discovered and what's happened since.
Sure. It is a long-running project. It was first discovered all the way back in 1988. When they were adding an attached garage to an existing house and a property in western North Dakota. And the individuals doing the construction work as they were digging the foundation for the garage ran into some large bones that were unearthed out of the ground. And at that time, they showed it to the landowner, and the landowner was not that interested in the discovery. And since it was private land, fossils on private land belonged to the private landowner. And so he had them just pile the bones that had been unearthed back up against the foundation when they went to backfill at the end of the project and left it alone. And at that time, word did get out to the Geological Survey, who I work for now, and one of the geologists went out to check on the site, but by the time he got there, everything had already been backfilled and covered over. But he kept that in his mind through the years, and he is now the state geologist, Ed Murphy. And last year, he decided to check up on the property and see if it was still the same landowner and if anything had ever happened with that specimen. And it turned out there was a different landowner now. And this new landowner was very open to the idea of exploring to see if these rumors about there being a mammoth skeleton were true or not. And so that's when our most recent project picked up on this earlier this year. So in May, we went out along with archaeologists from the State Historical Society that brought a ground penetrating radar setup that allows us to shoot radar down into the ground and then get reflections back and look for large buried objects underground. And usually this is used to find, like buried foundations and things like that that are very different from the surrounding material. It doesn't get used a lot for fossils, but in this case, we were looking for a very large animal, a mammoth, and we were hoping that some of the larger bones would be big enough that they might show up on this ground-penetrating radar. And so we ran grids around the garage on all sides and got some interesting returns from the ground-penetrating radar. And between that and getting back in touch with some of the individuals that had done the original construction work and getting their stories on where material should be at underground, we did a quick test pit in May and did uncover a couple of bones that looked to be from mammoth down at about the level that we would expect them to be at. And so we have our public fossil digs we run every summer. So we had to pause for June through August and take care of that work. But we returned then in September and opened up a large scale pit, ended up being about 2 meters by 4 meters that we opened up north of the garage and dug down. And we've uncovered several dozen partial bones so far that came out, and a few of them isolated, we're able to just take right out of the ground. And then there were 10 plaster protective jackets that we formed as well to take out some of the more fragile material. And there's still more to go. at the site, but that's as much as we could get done this fall before we had to move on to other things. But so far, everything that we're being told by the original construction crew in terms of what bones they thought they found and where it should be all matches up really well. But unfortunately, that means that in their story, most of the specimen is under the slab that was laid for the main garage, which means that much of this animal is probably directly underneath the existing garage.
And your ground penetrating radar can't quite see underneath that cement. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So if it had just been like poured cement with nothing else in it, we might have the ability to get through it with the ground penetrating radar. But because it has both rebar and some metal mesh that's inside to give it strength, which is pretty typical. All that metal reflects the signal back almost immediately, and we don't get enough signal through to see what's underneath.
So Dr. Boyd, give me some context about what a mammoth is. I was surprised that they've been in North Dakota relatively recently.
Yeah, so they persisted in North America and into North Dakota up until about 10,000 years ago. It varies a little bit, when you get the last occurrences, but about 10,000 years ago is the last occurrence. This specific specimen, we've sent a piece of bone out and got an age back of about 13,500 years on it. So it's on the younger side for a mammoth, but they're here right up to the end of the last ice age, which is about 10,000 years ago.
And a mammoth is about the size of an elephant. Is that an accurate description?
They're a little bit bigger than most modern elephants. They're a little taller at the shoulder, a little more upright in stance, but they're very large animals. Yeah.
So what happens next? How do you continue the project?
So there's kind of two phases as we look ahead at what to keep doing at the site. The first is to continue what we're already doing, which is to work in a very organized, very methodical, meter by meter grid outside of the garage, collecting all of the bones that are in place in the ground outside. And so, like I said, we did that for 2 meters by 8 meters, so 8 grids that we've cleared out so far. But the bones have continued a little bit further to the north. And so we do need to keep doing some of that work to make sure we get absolutely everything that's outside the garage. But then the second phase is eventually, if we want to recover all the specimen, we need to cut through the slab in the garage and actually get underneath the slab there and hopefully find what is the main concentration of bones there.
Is this a rare find for North Dakota?
So we do get isolated bones from mammoths, not that uncommonly in North Dakota. Find an isolated tooth here, a bit of bone there, a piece of tusk there. Specimens that are like partial skeletons where you've got quite a bit of an animal there are not very common in North Dakota for whatever reason. We just haven't had much luck in finding them. We did collect a partial specimen that had about 20 bones preserved out of the Freedom Mine in Beulah, North Dakota last year, including a really beautiful 7-foot long tusk. But this specimen could potentially be even more complete than that if it does continue underneath the slab. The other thing that's interesting about this specimen is as we've been cleaning up the bones, it turns out that it's from a juvenile, a not fully grown individual. That we have even less of in our collections is juvenile material. So it would be even more interesting to get this specimen out and see exactly how old it was, maybe how it died, and anything else that it can tell us about that time period.
There were local students assisting already with this dig?
Yeah, so when we first went out in May, the local school brought the school kids out, class at a time, kindergarten and first grade, second grade. And throughout the day as we were working, the first classes would show up and we had just finished the ground penetrating radar. We were just starting to dig our first test pit. And so since we had to get down, the bones are about 30 inches below the ground. We had some of the students assist us in removing some of that overlying rock to get that, or overlying soil, it's not really rock, to get down closer to the specimen. And then as the day would go on, like an older class would come and we're a little bit further down. And by the end of the day, we managed to expose those first couple bones. And so that class then, when they returned back to the school, got to the school and told everybody else, like, hey, they've actually found bones. And there was a big cheer that, that we'd found stuff there and we were being successful. And then when we went back in September, the same school brought several of the classes out again so that they could see kind of the progression of work at the site. They were there when we first started a test pit. Now we had this big excavation open with several bones exposed and they could see how that's progressed so far. So it's been a good, interactive experience for the local school kids.
your publications that you've written cover diverse topics, really, from mammoth fossils to dinosaur anatomy. What interests you the most about what you do day in and day out, Dr. Boyd?
Paleontologists can be broken down in a few different ways based on what they study. There's people who focus on like specific animals. So they say like, I really like, say, this type of meat-eating dinosaur, and most of my research is going to be on this one species. And then there's other ones that say like, well, if there's a specific kind of general field that I like, you know, say that it's like studying past environments or something like that and learning about how the environment has changed over time. And that's what they focus on. And in my position here working for the State Geological Survey, my work has to be confined within the state because that's who I work for. And so I follow what I call more of a question-based research program, which is I want to find unanswered questions about fossils or prehistoric environments in North Dakota. And when we get good pieces of evidence about that, I want to follow up on it. And so, like you said, my publications tend to be rather diverse in scope because, you know, there's a wide range of ages and different types of animals that we find here in North Dakota. And as long as there is an interesting question to be asked about those fossils that's important to study, that's what I want to do. And so my research does tend to be kind of, you know, all over the place with that kind of stuff, but it keeps it fresh. You know, you never know what you're going to be doing from year to year and what you're going to find when you go out.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Clinton Boyd. He earned his PhD in geosciences from the University of Texas at Austin in 2012, and he manages the paleontology program for the North Dakota Geological Survey and serves as curator of the North Dakota State Fossil Collection. What's the coolest fossil in the North Dakota State Fossil Collection, Dr. Boyd?
That pretty definitively is our Dakota the Dinosaur Mummy, which is a fossilized specimen of the duck-billed dinosaur Edmontosaurus from the very end of the age of dinosaurs. And it is very well preserved. We have most of the skeleton, and it's so well preserved that we even have the actual skin preserved over most of the specimen. Not like an imprint of the skin, but the actual three-dimensional skin preserved. So that's kind of our crown jewel of the North Dakota State Fossil Collection.
Where can people see the collection?
So our collection is stored in the North Dakota State Museum and Heritage Center on the Capitol grounds in Bismarck. But we do have 26 different exhibits across the state in different small museums and visitor centers all over. So our main exhibit is here in Bismarck, but we do have little exhibits all across the state if people are interested in seeing some of the stuff that we found.
What's the most exciting or impactful fossil discovery that you've worked on during your time in your current role?
Well, I am doing some research on our dinosaur mummy that I mentioned. That's been very interesting for me. Otherwise, we're doing a lot of research right now on fossil crocodiles from North Dakota from just before the end Cretaceous extinction and just afterwards. And so looking at how does our crocodile fauna change from before the extinction event to after the extinction event here in North Dakota. I mean, that's actually turning up some pretty interesting results and what's probably going to be several new species of smaller crocodiles. So everyone likes to think of the giant, like dinosaur hunting size crocodiles in the Cretaceous, but there was quite a diversity of kind of dwarfed smaller species of crocodilians at this time that have kind of been ignored just because they weren't big and flashy. And we're getting a very good record of those critters. And so over the next few years, we'll be publishing on some of those. I think people will find quite interesting.
Dr. Boyd, I hail from Wyoming, and everybody can name one of Wyoming's national monuments, and that is Devil's Tower. But they struggle to name the second one, and that's Fossil Butte National Monument. Does North Dakota have a place that's similar in makeup to Wyoming's Fossil Butte National Monument, where there are literally just fossils everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to match Fossil Butte. That's just an amazing place. We do have a deposit that is similar in preservation in North Dakota, which is just outside the town of Sentinel Butte, North Dakota, in the western edge, where there is a preserved pond deposit up on top of Sentinel Butte that has similarly preserved fish fossils to what you find at Fossil Butte. They're a little bit younger in age than the ones that are at Fossil Butte. And unfortunately, nowadays, it was a very popular place when it was first discovered for people to collect these little beautiful sunfishes, is what most of them are at that site. And now there's not really any more exposed. There's probably more of the layer there, but it's buried underneath the ground. You'd have to dig way back in to get it. But the fossils that we have from there, we've got a pretty good collection of them. And they're just beautifully preserved fish, you know, in that nice kind of flat panel view that you typically think of for those fish from Fossil Butte. So we do have some fish like that. Otherwise, in terms of just like abundance of fossils coming out, we do have some outcrops of what's called the White River Group, which is a Oligocene age, about 32 million years old. Most of those are just south of the town of Dickinson, although there's some down by the town of Amadon as well in the very southwest corner of the state. Those are mostly mammal fossils that we get in those sites and very productive beds from there. People don't get quite as excited when we want to go out there and they're like, well, what are you going to look for? Are you looking for dinosaurs? We're like, no, we're looking for mammals. In fact, there's a lot of like fossil mice from here. And then we get fossil mice, like, okay, whatever. Like, well, but they are fun. They're interesting. And, you know, they tell us a lot about the environment back then. I do have a soft spot for them.
I want to talk to you about the challenges in your work. You must assume that funding and fiscal support is one of them. You'd probably like to do much, much more, but have to prioritize what you can do.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the case for everybody. You know, there's always more that you would like to do with more funding, but we do, I would say, get very good support from the state of North Dakota for our program. In general, I found that, you know, North Dakotans are very interested in paleontology, and we've had very good support for all the projects that we've been doing, including our public fossil digs that we run every summer, 43 days of those. There's always more that you could be doing, but we have a pretty good program here. And in fact, we're one of the largest, if not the largest, paleontology programs at a state geological survey in the country. So I think that we have to be especially thankful for.
Do you teach as well, Dr. Boyd, in your current role?
I do not. We do have some affiliation with both University of North Dakota and North Dakota State as far as collaborating on research. And in fact, the Geological Survey used to be a part of the geology department at the University of North Dakota originally, but that was changed in the 80s. And so at this point, we don't do any college level teaching, although as part of our public fossil digs, we do offer a continuing education course for teachers that they can take and come out with us. There's a day in the classroom here in our collections, and then a day out in the field with us to learn more about paleontology and how to adapt those concepts for their classroom.
Speaking of classroom, would you give advice to kids that this is a great field to pursue a career in?
I might be a little biased. I think it's a wonderful career to follow into. It does take, you know, some persistence. There's a lot of training and education that you have to go through to get to the point where you can do it as a full-time occupation. There's a bit of competition as well because it is a very flashy, interesting field. But what I like about it is that going to work every day doesn't really feel like work because there's always fun things that we're doing. There's new things that we're discovering. Every time we go do field work, you know, you're finding fossils that no one, even if it's a species that we've seen before, that specific fossil has never been seen before by human eyes when it gets discovered. And that never gets old for me. And there's really nothing that can take the place of that in my view. And so people that feel that way, you know, I think all of the effort and challenges are worth it to get to the point where you can enjoy that every day.
Is it hard for you to balance the work that you want to do with the public outreach and education that you also do in your job?
It can be a bit. And I think the most successful way to do that is what we try to do, which is to try to blend our outreach activities with the research activities so that they're not entirely separate activities that we're doing. So it's not like, well, either we do our research stuff or we do these educational programs. You know, for our public fossil digs, we take the participants to our research sites. We're not just taking them to like some random place where like, oh, we can maybe find some fossils here, but you know, they're not super important fossils. So, you know, if something happens to them, it doesn't matter. It's like, no, we take them to our research sites and have them help us collect the important specimens that we're going to work on. And so by combining those two things up, it doesn't become an either or, it becomes a, how do we layer these things together in a way that makes all of the things that we need to get done work together synergistically and reach a positive conclusion.
So as you look forward at both the short term and the longer term future here with your work here in North Dakota, what are your goals? What projects do you want to accomplish in your role as senior paleontologist?
So one big thing that we've been working on is getting better ages on all of the rocks exposed on the surface of North Dakota, and doing that through studying the fossils that are there. And so just doing very, very detailed, like down to like collecting every few centimeters from these rocks and recovering the specific fossils that are there, and then using that to correlate to other areas. That's a big project that we have, so that we have a really kind of precise understanding of when different rocks are being deposited in North Dakota, when different environments are here in North Dakota, so we can better understand North Dakota's past. But we also have, you know, broader goals of bringing our program even more into the forefront for the public to see. And so, like right now, we have our public fossil dig program where people can come out and dig with us. And we want to supplement that with a viewable fossil prep lab here at the State Museum in Bismarck in the gallery upstairs. Because right now, all of our cleaning and stabilizing of fossils happens downstairs in the staff area. And what we'd like to get is what some museums have, which is a public fossil prep lab up where people can watch all of that work happen. That way, if they join us on the public fossil digs, they can see fossils being discovered and removed from the ground. They could come into the museum and they can see fossils being taken out of those field jackets and cleaned up and stabilized, and then see the end result in the exhibits of those fully cleaned and stabilized fossils that we found from North Dakota. And so then every step of what we do is in public view for people to understand how these fossils are being found and how we learn from them. And so it's not an opaque process of just being given information from scientists. It's a process where they can see every bit of what's going on. And so that's another big goal that we have.
Complete this sentence as we leave today, Dr. Boyd. It would be the biggest surprise to people from North Dakota that what has lived here in the past?
Oh boy. One thing that when we give tours of our collections and show people stuff that I think people find the most interesting is those rocks that I mentioned south of Dickinson from the White River Group, about 32 million years old. One of the main animals that we find there is an animal called Subhyracodon, which is an extinct rhinoceros. And I think a lot of North Dakotans are surprised to learn that we used to have rhinoceros in North America. And in fact, rhinos first evolved in North America before spreading elsewhere and then going extinct here. And so showing them these like very large rhino skulls that we get out of there, just beautifully preserved, I think adds another layer for people. People think about dinosaurs, right? You know, and then they expect like, oh yeah, there was these things like dinosaurs that are completely extinct now that used to be here. But to show them an animal that, you know, fits with our modern world, like we can imagine what a rhinoceros is, but we can't really imagine one here in North Dakota, but they were here originally. And without the fossil record, you know, we would never know that. And so I think that's one of the things that people find most interesting.
Dr. Clint Boyd manages the paleontology program for the North Dakota Geological Survey and serves as the curator of the North Dakota State Fossil Collection. And he's been my guest today on Main Street. Dr. Boyd, best wishes with the mammal work that you're pursuing, and best wishes also with the rest of your tasks. Thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
Happy to be here.
One night while sleeping in my bed, I had a beautiful dream that all the people of the world got together on the same wavelength and began helping one another.
Think globally, act locally. Giving Tuesday is the day to do just that. I'm Ann Ahlquist. The worldwide generosity movement Giving Tuesday was founded in 2012 to unlock the power of people and organizations to transform their communities and the world. One way you can help is by giving a gift to the public media organization that serves North Dakota and our Prairie region with reliable, trusted, independent journalism, non-commercial programs that uplift, inspire, and delight, and educational services that help power the future. That would be Prairie Public. So on this Giving Tuesday, please go to prairiepublic.org, make a donation of any amount, and be part of the global chain of generosity. And thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll visit with Merrill Pepcorn. He's back on Prairie Public sharing Dakota date books with us, but he'll also reflect on his time as a candidate for North Dakota governor. That's coming up right after this. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the FM Area Foundation, offering the Caring Catalog, December 2nd through the 13th, an online giving platform connecting community members with local nonprofits during the holiday season. Learn more at areafoundation.org. FM Area Foundation, connecting people and purpose.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and I am pleased to be joined by a voice you've all heard probably more than mine, Merrill Pepcorn. Merrill, welcome to Main Street.
Glad to be here, especially as a former host of this time slot that you fill. It used to be called Hear It Now. It's called Main Street now, and you've been the host for a couple of few years here. And yes, I'm a regular listener. So.
Well, I appreciate that, Merrill, but we get to hear you now on Dakota Datebook. You've done that for several years.
Gosh, you know, that's a former director of radio, Bill Thomas, who I just saw recently at a concert. It was his brainchild, this Dakota Datebook series, and I believe he got it cranked up about 18, maybe 19 years ago, and I've been voicing it since the very beginning, except for when I'm campaigning, because of the equal time provisions of campaigning.
Once you announced, you got your respite from us, but boy,
yeah.
And then you went to work, right?
That's exactly right. So. But then once I was elected, then I got to come back on and do Dakota Datebooks again. So we have had some interruptions, but it's really been a fun, great project for me.
I want to reflect today, Merrill, on your campaign. You just ran for governor of the state of North Dakota for the Democratic NPL ticket.
Correct.
Merrill, why did you run? What made you want to run for governor? And I reflect back to the day that you told me you were going to do this, and I asked you, well, do you have $1 million? Because it's so much about money these days. What made you want to run?
As I looked over the political landscape, as it's referred to, I thought I would be the most electable candidate the Democratic Nonpartisan League Party could put out. And I'll refer to it often as the Dem-NPL Party, but I'm so proud of that nonpartisan league history of the Dem-NPL that I always, at least at the beginning of a conversation, bring that up because it's an important part of our state's history too. But because of my work in public radio, because of my music work, my musical group, the Radio Stars, has toured all across the state. I participate in our Messiah Lutheran Church service, which is televised statewide, and it has been for some 56, 57 years now. And I thought, well, you know, I'm probably the best known person in the Dem-NPL party, for starters, just right out of the gate, politics aside. I thought, well, I'm the best known. And therefore, we've got at least a good head start. And we can campaign and tell other people about who I am and who we are in the Dem-NPL and have a good shot at getting elected. So that's why I really
threw my hat. Great legislative service background, too.
Well, I do have that. November 30th was my last day as North Dakota State Senator representing District 44 in North Fargo.
Sure, campaigns are full of highs and lows. Monday morning quarterbacking probably happens a lot in these things, I'm guessing. How about for you?
Well, I will tell you, there's not much that I would have done differently. I think I probably depended on my reputation too much, people knowing me, or people knowing me and then figuring it, because they knew me, they'd vote for me. Maybe that was a miscalculation. But I thought our main goal would be to get the voters of North Dakota to feel or to understand like they knew me, like my neighbors know me.
There has to have been lessons learned either by you or by the party.
Well, I think one lesson that I learned is that, I don't know if I actually learned it, but one of my teammates, I'll call my two major teammates, were Katrina Christensen, who ran for U.S. Senate, Trigvi Hammer, who ran for the U.S. House, both really good people, good hearts, good experience, and would have been great representatives for North Dakota in the United States Congress, in the Senate and the House. Katrina, I believe, somewhere in $1.5 million, maybe more. Trigvi was up around $1 million, maybe more. And I had a campaign budget of $200,000. Now, they also engaged the services of professional fundraising organizations. To their credit, I decided not to do that. And I raised $200,000 plus, a little bit more than that, from everyday people of North Dakota and some friends, some family friends, and some high school classmates who got word of my running and so on and so forth. I don't think another $1 million would have got me maybe a couple of few thousand more votes or a couple of percentage points. So I just don't think that that the money was the primary goal, the thing that we missed out on. We covered a lot of territory, met a lot of people, and I just don't think there's that much more that I could have done to generate more votes in this political climate now.
What messages do you feel didn't connect with North Dakota voters that you really thought might?
Well, I thought one thing that people would understand is that the politics in North Dakota is very heavily influenced by the oil and not so much lignite coal industry, by the fossil fuel industry. Now, I am not an extreme environmentalist. I would classify myself as a conservationist. I know several agriculture groups and other property owner groups who are considered conservationists. They are respectful of the soil and are not really environmentalists, but they love the soil, they love the land. And I thought our message of being conservationists and respectful of the land and letting those principles guide our economics when it comes to energy development would resonate a little bit more. But there's no way that I or anybody that I work with is out to close down the oil companies. But I think whenever you say anything that kind of smacks of a little bit of a hint of, well, I'm not 100% sure that the oil company should be running our state, duh, you know, I think that the alarm bells ring, and they have a very strong influence in the government of North Dakota.
Visiting at a coffee shop downtown,
yeah.
And as you said that, a fire truck just drove by with its lights on. I just thought that was a little ironic. Speaking of alarm bells,
yeah.
Do you feel you were painted into corners that you didn't deserve to be painted into in the election?
Not really, but I didn't do much painting either. I don't think this would, what we didn't do, and I had a really good campaign team, mostly volunteers. I had one paid staffer who worked at least twice as hard as any other campaign manager and was paid probably half of what most are. We got out of a service of love. Shannon Sharpenter is her name. She did a wonderful job. We're friends. I used to work for her 30 years ago. So we had that. But we did not go, okay, now what is my opponent? Kelly Armstrong is the governor-elect of North Dakota. And we didn't go after, okay, now what did he do here? What can we dig up on Kelly Armstrong where we can really pin him on something? And so we didn't do that.
Are you glad you didn't?
Yes. And not that I would have found anything anyway or used it. I've always taken a high road, and I get, during the campaign, and this is probably what I am proudest of, during the campaign and now after the campaign, people thank me for our approach to campaigning for governor. And even with the results where we were defeated quite handily, people were still come up and go, we're really proud of the way you ran that campaign. And you know, we got, well, I'm gonna round up a little bit here, but almost 100,000 people in the state did vote for us. Patrick Hart was my lieutenant governor running mate. So, you know, that's pretty significant. So that's what I'm proudest of. And I don't think I would have changed anything. I think we did the best we could with what we had, where we are right here in North Dakota, and that's keeping to the high road during this campaign.
We're enjoying our conversation with Merrill Pepcorn. He just ran for governor in the state of North Dakota and was defeated by Kelly Armstrong, and we're debriefing Merrill after his campaign. What's North Dakota's biggest challenge, Merrill? If you can reduce it down to one thing, what is it?
It's getting people from Wyoming to move to North Dakota.
We gave you two. Is that enough?
Yeah, and well, in fact, I think one of the reporters for the Monitor News Service, which is relatively new in town, I think she came up from Wyoming as well. You probably have met her out during the course of your work. So maybe those are the two you're thinking of. But again, it is attracting and retaining workers. For so many years, it was like economic development. We got to develop jobs. We got to have good, high-quality jobs to keep our young people in the state. And now it's like, well, we still need to do things to keep them in the state, but we're competing against every other state for workers, for people. So I think that's the main challenge is, you know, it's unusual for North Dakota over the past several decades because it's been a slow drain of population, but we have had an increase of population. But then, you know, how do you do that? By providing the services for people in the state. I think some of the social issues that came up during the last legislative session younger people, young working people, young family people. These are issues that they, where the government wants to stick their nose into people's private lives, such as sexual orientation, such as abortion. There we've said that we were able to bring that word into the discussion, and I think it's important too. Library books being banned, certain access to mental health care and to drug and alcohol treatment. That those are important things to us, but we have to make those social services available and not be so concerned legislatively about having the government stick our nose into people's business. The Republican Party has traditionally been a party with that attitude. You know, just leave the people alone, connect the government to business, raising taxes, doing roads, and pay for education. And I think we've kind of gone too far in social legislation. And that is not going to help attract young people to North Dakota.
Merrill, this state has a very diverse post-secondary education system with its colleges and two major universities. And I'm sure you've thought about that a lot. Is it sustainable the way it's laid out today?
Boy, there have been a lot of approaches.
Let me ask you why I ask you that question. Generally speaking, someone from the Democratic NPL party would be more in to making sure that our college system survives and is as diverse as it is today. Others may not have that same point of view.
Well, I know the current governor, at least when he was initially campaigning for governor 8 years ago, was really big on making the college education much more virtual, closing down campuses, and not being so concerned about having people on campus. And there have been efforts to close campuses over the years for Valley City, Mayville State, even Dickinson, Bottineau. And I have never supported that. I believe it's an important part of growing up for people to attend college. But with that in mind, of course, Minnesota has made some significant, made into law significant programs making it more affordable and actually paying for college education for folks who just can't afford it, a certain income guidelines. So I think we have to look at some of those things. But I just think it's important for young people to get on a campus. You know, how many people meet their spouses, you know, while they're going to college, for example. And I think that integration and communication and getting on and doing things with other people on a college campus is extremely important.
How do you feel you differentiated yourself from Kelly Armstrong? You didn't want to go negative and point out any past dirt, so to speak.
Yeah.
So you had policy differences. What were the major ones?
Well, I think a lot of that came down to social issues. And abortion was probably one very big one. Because, not women's rights, but, you know, I've long contended that the North Dakota legislature, the makeup of the legislature, does not reflect the population of the state.
In what way?
Well, in, for example, our strict abortion law, which I believe, as we are speaking, that law was rescinded by a U.S. district judge, and North Dakota now is suing. And so now we're spending our resources suing to get this law, which is extremely restrictive and, you know, really out of date and out of touch with the public, to get that reinstated.
And
I think that's a waste of money.
Is it out of touch with the Republicans in this state, Merrill?
Well, you know, it's out of touch with the Republican legislators. And again, I don't think a lot of people who vote for Republicans realize the makeup of the Republican Party leadership and those in office. This is not the Republican Party that my parents, that the atmosphere, the environment that I was raised in. I was raised on a farm family out just west of Minot, North Dakota, Montreal County, near Stanley, North Dakota. And it truly was, you know, conservative fiscally, and not just pick yourself up by your bootstraps, but taking care of each other, taking care of our neighbors and the government when it needed to step in and help do that. And now I think it has evolved into a very loud and a very aggressive, extremely socially conservative party. And I think a lot of people still just vote for Republicans because it does have an R behind its name. However, I also believe that our North Dakota Democratic Nonpartisan League Party has suffered from the current methods of delivering what is called, and I'm using air quotes here, one of my least favorite things when we're talking to each other, putting those quote marks up on either side of my head, the delivery of the news. People are just selecting the news that they want to hear, that they've been told they should listen to, and I think that the North Dakota Democrats have been painted into the corner as being just another part of a national Democratic Party that is promoting extremist legislation.
I lament often on the death of the newspaper.
Yeah.
And I think certainly in rural North Dakota, it's a big, big issue.
Yeah.
I really do.
I have learned that the people just still do read the small county papers, but there are fewer and fewer of them. And one paper might serve five communities or regions where there used to be five papers. So yeah, that's disturbing. I do appreciate the North Dakota News Cooperative, which is a new source of news. I believe that was started by Steve Andrus, a former newspaper editor and head of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, and also the presence of the Monitor News as well. So I think having those two sources of news reporting has helped, although nothing can really replace those local and county newspapers.
Governor Burgum is going to present his budget tomorrow. Kelly Armstrong is going to give the state address soon.
Right.
I'm guessing that he's going to say the state of North Dakota is strong. Do you agree with that?
Well, financially, we're strong. But it's what are we doing with our money? What's the role? I believe a friend of mine who's just a smart guy and a good guy and keeps track of things, what you boil it down to, what's the primary purpose of government is to, good roads and good education. So if you want to just boil it down to those two things, we could spend a lot on roads and education. For example, I believe that North Dakota, the state of North Dakota, can ante up. Right now, the state of North Dakota pays for about two-thirds of the cost of educating a student, a K-12 student. I believe the state of North Dakota has the resources, and whether that be tapping into the legacy fund, everybody says let's tap into that legacy fund. There are ways to do it, but however we would do it right now, it would cost the state, I can't put a dollar figure on it, hundreds of millions of dollars to ante up and pay for the entire cost of educating a K-12 student, thereby reducing the pressure on the local school districts to always be issuing these bond issues to fund their local schools.
Are you suggesting the state then should build schools?
Yeah, perhaps, and build doing infrastructure and also paying for some of the other associated costs with. Yeah, I think the state can do that, helping update infrastructure and build schools. Yeah, perhaps. It'd take a lot of work.
As a former candidate, Merrill?
Yeah.
Do you see yourself being candidate Merrill Pepcorn again someday soon?
Not statewide, nor for state office. I'm 75 years old. I hang out with a younger crowd. I don't believe my thoughts and actions are antiquated. But one thing that has happened, because I decided to step aside and run for governor, that meant my colleague for the past 8 years in the House has been Josh Boucher. He ran unopposed for the Senate seat in District 44. But that opened up a House seat for a younger person to come in, a young guy named Austin Foss. And he was Austin's indebted to me, for quite some time for stepping into politics, running unopposed for his first run in office. So I've got that hanging over him, but he'll take to it. But, there's an opportunity for a younger person to step in there. So I will be and always have been involved in my local politics. When it come to my school in my neighborhood 20 years ago, they tried to close our Horace Mann School in my district. That's what got me involved in politics in the first place. A lady by the name of Tracy Walmotney, who's been my treasurer in various campaigns over the years, got me involved with the Save Our School campaign. And that's what got me involved in politics. So there's always issues like that. A quality of life in Fargo, North Dakota, in Cass County, and other ag issues statewide I'm interested in too. So I'll be interested. Maybe I think I can be more effective maybe in helping people with different issues and causes as a citizen with some knowledge of how the legislature works than perhaps as a legislator. So I'll keep in touch both on a local level and what's going on a statewide level.
You're concerned that term limits is getting rid of so much institutional memory?
Yeah.
That'll be to the state's detriment, or is that a good thing?
I think that 8 years is too short a time for a term limit. I would have been more generous and gone for maybe even 16 years. 16 years sounds like a long time, but 16 years in one chamber or the other, or both combined. Right now, you can serve 8 years in the Senate, and then you can serve another two terms or 8 years in the House. But, you know, those are two different animals, too. So I think the term limits is not going to help. It'll just put more power into into the Commerce Department, into the Treasurer's Office, into the Secretary of State's office, into the Governor's office. And so there will be more policy, I think, because there's so much turnover in newcomers that they'll have to rely more on what is already there. So departments will come to the legislature and tell them what they need, and I'm generalizing here, rather than the legislature, you know, necessarily bringing their ideas to them. I think it'll be more of a one-way street coming in from the established government. So, yeah, I don't think it's a good thing, but, you know, on the other hand, there will be a lot of fresh faces. We'll see.
Meryl Pepcorn, if there's a silver lining, I'm glad you're reading Dakota date books again. Thank you for running. Well, I'm glad you kept the seat warm for me on Main Street, Meryl. And I'm glad that you've been my guest today. Thanks for joining us.
That also has been one of the really highlights of my professional life, and I wish you all the best. Glad you're here, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation. Proud to partner with Strengthen ND to announce the 2024 Bush Prize North Dakota winners, North Dakota Native Vote, and North Dakota Assistive. More information online at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 3rd. The entire country was shocked when news came of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. 268 soldiers of the 7th Cavalry were killed, including the handsome and popular Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. With the regiment posted at Fort Abraham Lincoln, residents of Dakota Territory felt they had a personal interest in the 7th Cavalry. They were stunned when Captain Grant Marsh piloted the steamboat Far West to the dock, and they watched as the wounded were unloaded. Among the survivors was Captain Thomas Maurer McDougall. He was the son of Brevet General Charles McDougall, so it was natural that he became a career soldier. He was only 17 in 1863 when he served with General Ulysses S. Grant during the Civil War. A year later, he was commissioned as second lieutenant with the 48th Colored Infantry. He mustered out of the Army after the Civil War, but within a year, he was back with the 32nd Infantry as a second lieutenant. He rose to the rank of first lieutenant and then captain. Later, he was assigned to the 7th Cavalry in December of 1870. McDougall was in command of the pack train at Little Bighorn. Custer sent two urgent messages to him to bring up the mules with ammunition. But by that time, there was heavy fighting between McDougall and Custer. He was unable to reach Custer, but managed to join Major Reno and engage in the fighting with Reno's unit. On this date in 1877, the Bismarck Tri-Weekly Tribune observed that the garrison at Fort Abraham Lincoln was complete with the arrival of Captain Howe's 17th Infantry from Fort Rice. The newspaper noted that Captain McDougall was at the fort with his company. He was described as one of the very best fellows in the regiment, and his wife as one of the most pleasant ladies. McDougall continued to serve with the 7th Cavalry, seeing actions in the Nez Perce War. He retired in 1890, and he and his wife moved to Wellsville, New York. He died in 1909. He and his wife are buried in Arlington Cemetery. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for this Giving Tuesday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent part of your day with us and for celebrating generosity in your communities. Tomorrow, we'll have an expanded edition of Prairie Plates featuring Dr. Greg Cook, a chemistry professor at NDSU and owner of 4E Winery in Fargo. Greg is a vegan cooking enthusiast with a YouTube channel The Pot Thickens, boasting nearly 60,000 subscribers. He'll share his expertise in creating homemade vegan dishes with ingredients from his own garden. Until then, thank you for listening, and thank you for considering giving today on Giving Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow right here on Main Street.